This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the third hour of our program. I promise you, Henry Wallace will be up next. But right now, Sanjeev Sriram is with us, Dr. Sanjeev Sriram, MD, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics at the George Washington University School of Medicine and Health Sciences, Medicaid and Medicare Advisor to Social Security Works. SocialSecurityWorks.org is the website. He is the host of the Dr. America program on We Act Radio, the website weactradio.com, our Washington, D.C. affiliate. You can tweet him at Dr. Sriram, S-R-I-R-A-M, or at We Act Radio. Dr. Sriram, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you so much for joining us. So Donald Trump is proposing to put in charge of Medicaid the woman who ran the Health and Human Services in Maine for crazed Governor Paul LePage, the right-wing whack job up there. Her name is Mary Mayhew. What do we know about Mary Mayhew?
So Mary Mayhew was the former health commissioner for the state of Maine, and like you said, she worked under Paul LePage. And while she was in that position, she eliminated nearly 70,000 people from Maine's Medicaid program, also called MaineCare.
How did she do that?
So, through a variety of ways, mostly by arguing that she was doing it for fiscal purposes and by scaling back, benefits and more or less, I would call it neglecting her job. There was a report from the Office of the Inspector General that came out regarding a fairly large number of patients, 133 very vulnerable patients who died on Mayhew's watch. And that was during the period of January 2013 to June 2015. And the reason why these patients died is that, first off, these are developmentally disabled adults. So these are very vulnerable patients. And they were already in trouble, like facing critical incidents for things like sexual assault, suicidal behavior, and suffering injuries that actually required hospitalization. And what the report found was that Mayhew's Department of Health and Human Services in Maine did a very poor job of requiring agencies to report these incidents, to follow up on those reports, to figure out, okay, why is this happening? Can we establish a pattern here that we can act upon? And then actually doing the enforcement work to protect patients. And so you have a ton of people who are losing health care. You have people who qualify for the program but are getting inadequate care. And it was so bad that you actually had 133 people die.
So here we have Maine, which is, population-wise, a very small state. I don't know off the top of my head. Perhaps you do. I'm guessing the population is probably around 4 or 5 million for the state.
About.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a wild guess on my part. But and during her reign, basically, it would probably be hyperbolic to say she killed 130-plus people, but they died as a consequence in part of what she was doing running that program. And in a state that small, she was successful in knocking 70,000 people off the Medicaid roll. What will she do to the entire United States, all 340 million of us, when Donald Trump puts her in charge of Medicaid nationally?
Right. So, Maine, I just double-checked it. It's 1.3 million people. So it's,
wow,
a smaller state.
So knocking 70,000 people off is a huge percentage
Exactly.
Wow.
Right. And so when you look at the national trend of Medicaid and CHIP, that's the Children's Health Insurance Program, that covers one in five Americans. So that's 20% of us, about 70-something million people. And if you are somebody like Mayhew who comes into this job and thinks, gosh, 70 million is too many people, that's a dangerous outlook and approach to a job where your first, the first duty of overseeing Medicaid is making sure is that everybody who is eligible for the program enrolled in the program, is everybody who is enrolled in the program getting the services that they are that they have a legal right to, and are we doing a good job? Like what? Like how are we doing on quality? How are we doing on efficiency?
Right.
And I don't think that Mayhew, like you know, has prioritized any of that.
Yeah, clearly, and you know, at least during her time in Maine. So the question. Donald Trump wants to put her in charge of Medicaid. Is this a process that Congress has any say over? Does this require, you know, for example, Senate approval? And if so, what's going on? And if not, what are our other options to inhibit his ability to do this or you know, slow it down, stop it, you know, ring the fire bell, whatever?
So what I would, from what I know about the process, it's that Seema Verma, the current director of the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who would be Mayhew's boss, has selected her. As far as who gives approval, it's a good question. I need to double check, but regardless of who the approval process is, I would say that it is always important to write your members of Congress to let them know that you are paying attention to this issue, that you have grave concerns, and that there are any number of people who are qualified to run Medicaid who are not committed to looking at patients as entries on a spreadsheet and eliminating them. Like there are plenty of people who could do this job without putting patients at risk.
Yeah. Whew. Amazing. So Mary Mayhew is on her way in, and if she does to the United States what she did to Maine, 70,000 people off. There's only 4 million people in Maine? 1.3 million in Maine. 70,000 she removed from the Medicaid roll. How big was the Medicaid roll before she removed it? Was it 200,000, 300,000, 100,000? I mean, what percentage of the total Medicaid? How much of an axe did she take to the program in Maine?
Yeah, that I need to actually double check the numbers. I want to say that it was that Maine is actually not that different from the rest of the country, where if you were to say 1 in 5, Mainers are. You know, qualifying for...
Oh, hey, I found it in this article. It says the group points out that under her stewardship, the state has reduced Maine CARES enrollment by 37%, taking health insurance away from approximately 80,000 poor Mainers. 37%. Yeah. So if we have 70 million people on Medicaid in the United States, and this, by the way, includes, you know, your grandma in the nursing home, right? If where Medicare slides over to Medicaid for that end of life stuff, if I have this right, and please correct me if I'm wrong.
I mean, Medicaid does, over half, depending on where you live, it's anywhere from half to two thirds of long-term care.
Right.
So even if your grandma is not at, you know, the end of life, if she's still in her own home, but getting somebody to come and help her with some activities of daily living, making sure that her refrigerator is stocked, that she's her toilet hygiene is good and clean. Those are services that Medicaid provides. If somebody like Mayhew looks at the budget and says, somebody's coming and seeing your grandma every day, maybe it needs to be just about every other day or once a week, you're going to be fine. Yeah. That's a tremendous loss for the dignity of our elderly.
Well, and it puts people at risk of dying. I mean, you know, again, she, you know, 130 plus people died while she was running this program in Maine because of her incompetence. When this gets applied, instead of being applied to, you know, a couple of 100,000 people, to 70 million people, if she tries to make a 38% cut in that, you know, you're knocking tens of millions of people off the Medicaid rolls or damaging it. So Dr. Sriram, thank you so much for being with us today.
Anytime.
Great talking with you, Dr. Sanjay Sriram. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Excuse me, it's Sanjeev Sriram. We'll be back in just a moment with Henry Wallace, my thoughts and your calls. And welcome back. Sunny in San Rafael, California. Hey, Sunny, what's on your mind today? Thanks for watching Free Speech.
Hi, Tom. Good to talk to you.
I wanted to talk about the message that we Democrats seem to be struggling with. Should we go high, go low, all that?
Okay.
Which, truly, I give up on MSNBC and CNN and all those in terms of, you know, shedding any light on that. I wanted to talk about how we separate Trump from this Death Star GOP in D.C. When we talk about Trump. And my recommendation, please, I want your opinion on this, Tom. We have to simplify this. For me, anyway, anything's simple when they get this complicated. When I hear Trump, I want to hear the D.C. GOP. I want to hear not Trump isolated from them. There was Gingrich who broke onto the scene in the 90s with this kind of virulent stuff, and he started playing to the C-SPAN cameras
in
chambers.
Yeah.
And perfected that, and then they perfected slowly Fox, and then I mean this has been going on for a long time. And Trump is the GOP; he is not.
Right. I think there was probably arguably reasonable separation of Trump and the GOP during the first say 10-12 months of his presidency, because he was screwing so many things up so badly, and so many Republicans were still speaking poorly of him. You know, and the obvious ones who didn't stop are now on their way out. You know, Bob Corker and Jeff Flake and whatnot, and a couple of members of the House, actually about a dozen members of the House. But then something happened after 10-12 months. It seems like, you know, sometime around the middle of last winter, it seemed that the Republican Party finally said, okay, you know, he's not going to self-destruct. He is learning how to at least pretend to be presidential, or at least our version of that. And he actually is building and strengthening his own base. And if we ignore that base, we do so at our own peril. The Tea Party has turned into the Trump Party. And so we better get in bed with this guy. And at that point, the GOP became the Trump Party. And I would say that happened probably 8 or 9 months ago. And the media, to your point, Sonny, and I think this is what you're saying, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the media hasn't acknowledged that merger.
No, they, for example, Lindsey Graham. On Tuesday, they'll say, what happened to Lindsey Graham? He used to be so never Trump-like.
Right.
And on Wednesday, they're like, here comes Lindsey. Listen to him. He's saying to those Saudis, get rid of that that MSB, the murder boy there,
right.
Solomon. And he's out there like the hero of the day. They're hopeless.
Yeah.
And I agree with you that it did take 10 to 12 months for this to mesh completely between Trump and the GOP. But I believe Trump is the GOP. I don't think he's anything but the GOP. I think they are, as Noam Chomsky, my hero, has been saying for years, that the most dangerous gang on this earth is the GOP in the United States of America.
Yeah.
Personally, I call them the Death Star, but I mean, that's just, I don't know.
Yeah, they complained about MS-13, but the Republican Party has been responsible, or at least their policies. For example, you know, refusing to expand Medicaid under Obamacare, and John Roberts is complicit in this. The GOP has been responsible for a lot of deaths in the United States, a lot of deaths. I mean, Harvard University was estimating it at 40,000 a year, or 24,000 a year after Obamacare. Sonny, thank you. Excellent point, one I hadn't considered. I appreciate it. We'll be right back. Welcome back, Zach. Zach, hold on here. I want to share this. I've been promising all day long that I'm going to share this Henry Wallace thing with you. I'm just going to get it done here, and then we'll get to your phone calls. This is from April 4th, 1944. And Henry Wallace was Vice President of the United States. And he writes, this is an op-ed that was published in the New York Times on April 4th, 1944. He says, on returning from my trip to the West in February, I received a request from the New York Times to write a piece answering the following questions. 1, what is a fascist? 2, how many fascists have we here in America? 3, how dangerous are they? And then he answers those questions. In fact, the title of the article is The Danger of American Fascism by Vice President Henry Wallace. He says the really dangerous American fascists are not those who are hooked up directly or indirectly with the Axis. It would be Germany and Japan. The FBI has its finger on those. The American fascist would prefer not to use violence. His method is to poison the channels of public information. With a fascist, the problem is never how best to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more money or power. American fascism will not be really dangerous until there is a purposeful coalition among the cartelists, the deliberate poisoners of public information, and those who stand for the KKK type of demagoguery. Are we there yet? Still another danger, Vice President Wallace wrote, still another danger is represented by those who pay lip service to democracy and the common welfare. In their insatiable greed for money and the power which money gives, do not hesitate surreptitiously to evade the laws designed to safeguard the public from monopolistic extortion. The symptoms of fascist thinking, Henry Wallace wrote, are colored by environment and adapted to immediate circumstance, but always and everywhere they can be identified by their appeal to prejudice and by the desire to play upon the fears and vanities of different groups of people in order to gain their own power. It is no coincidence that the growth of modern tyrants has, in every case, been heralded by the growth of prejudice. Are you listening to the words of the Vice President of the United States in 1944? The American fascists are most easily recognized by their deliberate perversion of truth and fact. Their newspapers and propaganda carefully cultivate every fissure of disunity, every crack in the common front against fascism. Are you starting to think about Fox so-called news and right-wing hate radio? They use every opportunity to impugn democracy. They use isolationism as a slogan to conceal their own selfish imperialism. They cultivate hate and distrust. They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by our Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but they are the spokesman for monopoly and vested interest. Their final objective, toward which all of their deceit is directed, is to capture enough political power so that, using the power of the state and the power of the market simultaneously, they may keep the common man in eternal subjection. We all know the part that the cartels played in bringing Hitler to power, and the role the giant German trusts have played in Nazi conquests. Monopolists who fear competition and who distrust democracy because it stands for equal opportunity would like to secure their position against small and energetic enterprise. In an effort to eliminate the possibility of any rival growing up, some monopolists would sacrifice democracy itself. We must not tolerate oppressive government or industrial oligarchy in the form of monopolies and cartels. And what do we have now? Literally every industry in America is now controlled by, you could call it a monopsony. Basically, that's where the buyers have maximum power rather than the sellers, so they control the marketplace. But I would say they're mini monopolies, right? I mean, you got, basically in the airline business, you got 3, 4, 5 airlines. In the pharmaceutical industry, you have a half a dozen pharmaceutical companies that control, in each case, they control anywhere from 65 to 90% of the market, right? That's a functional monopoly. In processed foods, in the growing, the raw material foods, in hog operations, some of the largest ones are not even American, they're Chinese owned. Cattle operations, electronics, computing, the internet, your television network. I mean, pick it, right? Pick anything, pick any area. Toothpaste. I mean, whatever it may be, what you will find is that the vast majority of the market is now monopolized. And that these corporations are feeding the politicians who keep their monopolies intact, which would be, by and large, the Republican Party, which, by the definitions of Henry Wallace, the Vice President of the United States in 1944, means that it has become a fascist party. Is it time to start using the F word, fascism, aggressively to define these guys. And without hyperbole, without exaggeration, just say, okay, this is exactly what Henry Wallace was talking about.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Up your calls right after the break. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, not too much, Tom. Hey, I wanted to make a comment about, you know, how the academic topic of fascism, all right?
Mm-hmm.
The you know what I'm saying? I don't mean it in a negative way. The, you know, the message about neoliberalism is getting out. I had a debate with a guy at work on neoliberalism, and I had to tell him finally that, hey, look, in my opinion, neoconservatism and neoliberalism is like choosing between hemlock and arsenic. You pick your poison, right? I mean, yeah. I have no...
Well, neoconservatism has its focus on war and imperialism, and neoliberalism has its focus on economics and you know, the power of the very wealthy. But there,
yes,
but there's a whole lot of conflation between the two.
There is. And, you know, we all go through periods where we're sympathetic to each, I think, you know. And the thing is I just want to, you set me up for my point really well. I think we are in a neoconservative cycle, really in the world, but in the Western world and specifically in America. And my issue with that is neoconservatism can slip. If the environment is correct, all right, if the environment is just right, it can slip into straight up academic fascism. Now, what kills my argument is we have elections, but this whole election thing is really minor. You know, is a minor aspect. All right, we cannot be fooled. We don't even know if these elections are legitimate. Number one. Number two is, all right, like if you look at recently this S-400 anti-aircraft system that the Russians are building, they're selling that to Turkey. Turkey is a NATO country. It is just a better weapon system for the price. Now, I read two articles. One, Russia is doing this to try to, you know, find out classified information about NATO air defense. Two, Russia is doing this to figure out how to shoot down the F-35. Well, if the neoconservatives figured this out, Boeing, Lockheed, and all of them figured this out, that the F-35, you know, the simple rule of government is why have one when you can have two for twice the price? They'll make an F-36, you know, just hypothetically.
Yeah.
And this is all, you know, the cycle of money, neoconservatism, and the evolution into fascism.
And I would say that most of this began, I mean, you know, we can track a lot of this back to the Vietnam War. In fact, we can track probably some of it back to the Korean War. But in a big way, it began after 9/11. And, of course, that was the neoconservatives', you know, big dream. I mean, their hallelujah moment that they talked about in 1998 in the Project for a New American Century, signed by Jeb Bush, among others, that basically said that implored Bill Clinton to attack Saddam Hussein and take down the government of Iraq. And so, you know, George W., when he became president, you know, everybody was talking about he was an illegitimate president, but hey, we had this great peace dividend. Remember the peace dividend that was at the end of the century? And, you know, because of the fall of the Soviet Union, and we didn't need to have all these nuclear weapons and all this stuff. And then 9/11 happens, and it's suddenly off to the races, you know, okay. And George Bush had a choice. He could have said, okay, you got 17 hijackers, 15 of them are Saudis. We're going to collaborate with Saudi Arabia, and we're going to collaborate with Afghanistan, where this apparently was plotted. And by the way, we had a decent relationship with Afghanistan at that point in time. Just 6 months earlier, George Bush had given $40 million to Afghanistan to distribute to their poppy farmers, and they had burned something like 70% of the poppy fields in Afghanistan enthusiastically in exchange for more money than they would have gotten if they'd grown the stuff and sold it. And so, you know, when Mullah Omar said, oh my God, this is a terrible thing that happened to you guys, we will arrest bin Laden and the 5,000 people who hang out with him here in Afghanistan, and we will turn, well, at least bin Laden anyway, we will turn them over to you, or not to the United States, but to a third, you know, a neutral third party. George Bush said, no, I want to have a war. And you know, and then Afghanistan, and then, of course, Iraq, and we lied us into Iraq, and here we are, both in both those wars. So we're still in that neoconservative moment. And I absolutely agree, Dave, that out of that, this is James Madison. This is exactly what James Madison was talking about. I've got the quotes someplace here, but I guess I don't have it where I can grab it. But James Madison said, no nation and no democracy can survive in a state of perpetual war. He said, in war, all the very worst things are amplified because so much more power goes to the executive, to the president. And therefore, war is the great enemy of democracy in the United States. He was absolutely right, and that's what we're seeing. Dave, you want to add to that before I move along?
Well, yeah, I just have a solution and a call to action. This is a Dave solution, all right? Mm-hmm. I say we have UN observers come in and check our elections. I mean, this is what...
Amen.
This is, you know.
You know, they tried to do that in 2004 in the John Kerry election, and the Republicans in the state, as I recall, it was in Ohio, the Republicans refused to let them come to the polling places.
Yep. A fascist America with our firepower, it's not good for the world.
Yeah.
I mean, we need to think about that.
There you go.
All
Dave,
right.
Thank you for the call. Zach in North Hollywood, California. Hey, Zach, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Boy, this ties in perfectly with what you guys are talking about. We're fighting 50 years of propaganda-driven sentiment on the Trump side. And you're right, the 9/11 was a springboard for what we're seeing now. But I think the media needs to embrace and get more familiar with the spectacle of handcuffs in prime time. I think they'd be surprised at how well they do. And we have a whole new crop of people to put handcuffs on. So my question for you is, we know what happened. Bernie had the bigger crowds and more juice than anyone in the 2016 primary, including Trump and Hillary. But the media gave Trump their blessing. We know that. So we all know they've been cheating the vote for 18 years.
They've been cheating the vote since Reconstruction.
Right.
I mean, what the Republicans are doing right now are the same damn Jim Crow things that were being done back in, you know, in 1880. It's just that they're being done in a slightly more sophisticated and subtle way.
Right. I'm not throwing my hands up here, but how is one midterm going to have the effect we want if we still don't have checks on a fair vote and ways to prove, you know, the cheating and enforce infractions?
Well, this is why we've got to flood the zone. I mean, we have to show up so many voters. We have to turn out so many voters that it overwhelms gerrymandering, that it overwhelms the rigging of the electoral system by throwing people off election rolls.
Either by count or removal.
Yeah. No, we have to flood the zone. And we need to be doing it with this election, and we need to be doing it 2 years from now in the 2020 election, and we need to be doing it big time. And if we don't, we're screwed. Zach, thank you. Excellent point. George in Chicago. Hey, George, you wanted to talk about polling deficiencies?
Well, I first wanted to say a big thank you for the wonderful conversation you had with Pete Tucker. That's why I and so many others make it a point to tune into your show every day. That was fantastically informative.
Thank you.
And I had hoped that one aspect of polling would have been addressed in the conversation, and perhaps you can do it with Mr. Tucker on a future interview. But it's my understanding that traditionally polling was done by calling people at home on their landline telephones. And we're all pretty familiar with the fact that particularly with millennials and younger people, they're not that likely to have landline phones. And particularly with black and brown younger people, they might be using throwaway cell phones that they use for a while and get another one with another number. So I'm just wondering about the mechanics and the nuts and bolts of being able to phone a large enough representative sample so that you can get a good result.
Yeah, I understand, George, and I don't know the answer to that. And that's essentially the question I asked Pete. I said, why is it that the supporters, the voters who are going to vote for progressive minorities are not being counted? And, you know, is it because there's been a radical increase in their number that hasn't been picked up by the pollsters? And he said he thought that was part of it, because their metric is not, you know, their benchmark, excuse me, is not the 2 year ago election, because that was a presidential year, but rather the 4 year ago election. And that was before Trump, and that was before, grab him by the crotch and all this other stuff. That was before Brett Kavanaugh. That was before, the Muslim ban and the Mexican rapists and all this other crap that has just completely energized and activated the progressive base. and people of color realizing that, you know, this now the Republican Party institutionally is on a daily basis using racism to go after them. But, you know, how, the mechanics of it, I don't know. And Pete didn't seem to know either, George.
Perhaps people see a number on their caller ID that they don't recognize. And if it's a pollster, they just hang up.
Yeah, well, it could be. I mean, I don't answer numbers that I don't recognize. It's just that simple. If somebody wants to reach me who is not on my list, they have to leave a voicemail and then I'll get back to them. But and probably more and more people are doing that. George, thanks a lot for the call. Good talking with you. And thanks for listening to WCPT.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Right back after the break with more of your calls here on the Tom Hartman program. It's 44 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. Vita in Addison, Illinois. Am I saying your name right? Vita, V-I-T-A, or Vita? Listening to, watching Free Speech TV? Vita, your phone is muted, maybe? Okay, I'm going to put Vita on hold. And Vita, I'm assuming she is on line two. And if you could find out what's going on, I appreciate it. Alan in Springdale, Utah. Hey, Alan, thanks for watching Free Speech. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Great program, especially the last couple of days. As I told your screener, you've been saying a lot about the influence we can have on people we know. And, you know, here in Utah, it's kind of John Bircher Light is the dominant politics. And it's so hard to unwind all of this basically propaganda. You know, I've got family members who are really good-hearted people, help a neighbor move and visit you at the hospital and stuff. But you start talking about the events and they just in the news and they just, you can't unwind all this preposterous.
Well, and even Mitt Romney, Alan, I mean, you know, back during the primaries, Mitt Romney just came right out and said, Donald Trump is a fraudster. He's a liar. He's a cheat. He's a hustler. He's a con man. I mean, these are all, I believe these are all words that Mitt Romney explicitly used to describe Donald Trump. And now that he's running for the United States Senate in Utah, in your state, he has walked away from all of that language. And now he's saying, well, I don't agree with Donald on everything, but he's a pretty good guy, you know, and these kind of things. I mean, I always thought of Republicans in Utah as being heavily influenced by the Mormon Church, which has a strong ethic of family and community. And therefore, they weren't quite as crazy as Republicans in the rest of the country. Was I wrong, Alan?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But
so what's happened to Romney?
Well, I mean, Romney wants to win, and so you know, he's I think he is really an anti-Trumper, and now he's too much of a Paul Ryan.
So you think that that Trump has had so much influence in Utah, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Orrin Hatch bears some responsibility for this because he's been, you know, Trump's best buddy there here for a while, that you've got to, that the Republican Party and most of the rest of the United States has become the Trump Party, certainly has in the South, that in Utah also it has. Is that what you're saying?
To a certain extent, it's just what you were describing earlier. And so, like, my younger brother, who lives in Lake Havasu City, Nevada, has been defending Trump.
Which is also a Mormon community, as I recall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Largely, yeah. And he's, you know, he's talking about just idiotic stuff, like Trump has reached out to the black community several times, and they keep rebuffing him. And I think that progressives need a different agenda, not sound like they're trying to go back to the America of the 70s and 60s and something to distract everyone.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have, you know, I mean, we had, you could get a decent education back in the 60s and 70s, but we didn't have health care for all. I agree with you, Alan, and I think that we need to be looking forward and we need to define those issues, and I think we largely have healthcare, education, and the economy. And let's move forward. Alan, thank you for the call. fair and only slightly unbalanced. Tom Hartman here with you. Britt in Eureka, California, listening on KGOE. Hey, Britt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Listen, I know I'm going back a little bit. You were talking earlier about concerns about climate change. And I have to be honest, I read an article, I believe it was in the Washington Post, this morning regarding the insect populations in the El Yunque forest in Puerto Rico.
The one I was remembering. I thought it was someplace else, but I thought it was Australia, Puerto Rico. You're absolutely right.
Well, yeah, it's a really concerning thing. I mean, you know, everybody hates to get a mosquito bite or a tick on you or something like that, but I should also point out that I'm a biologist in California here, and I really can't state how fundamental those organisms are to the health of the planet. I mean, so much of all of the animals that we see around us are literally feeding off of insects, or if not of insects, they're feeding off of other animals that do consume insects.
Right, this is the bottom of the food chain, or close to the bottom of the food chain.
This is probably one of the most crucial aspects of the environment that's now becoming to light as a result of this climate change. These insects do not have the capacity to deal with heat internally inside their bodies. Like, you know, dogs pant, we sweat. There's a variety.
Right, that was the big mammalian discovery or evolutionary leap, is to deal with temperature change.
Exactly. And unfortunately, the insects on the planet, although they do have the ability to move to cooler environment, you know, microclimates, you know, under a leaf or out of the sun or something, they don't have the ability to change the rising climate around them. So, you know, small changes in climate temperature they can deal with, but a consistent rise in climate change, you know, over, say, thousands or millions of years, the insects can evolve to deal with that. But over a very short period of time, they're not going to have the ability to have the capacity to evolve and to deal with that heat. And to, you know, we've been talking about how pollinators are disappearing from the planet, you know, bees and butterflies and all these types of insects. But now we're starting to see that even some of the more resilient insect species are disappearing. And it's an incredibly disheartening thing. When I read it this morning, it was very upsetting. And I just want to say that we need to look to elect politicians that can absolutely identify the crisis that we have with this climate right now. It's a very concerning thing. You know, all these things that we're worried about, healthcare and all this stuff, none of it means a thing when the planet goes up in smoke. I mean, we're literally on the edge of...
I'm completely with you, Britt. Britt, a quick question. Yeah. We've had this conversation dozens of times over the 15 years I've been doing this show, and it seems to be getting worse and worse. People will call in, particularly, and I mentioned this earlier, long-haul truckers, and they'll say, you know, it used to be when I drove through Georgia in May, or when I drove through Michigan in June, you know, my windshield would be covered with bugs. You know, every 2-3 hours I had to stop and scrape them off. And now, you know, I might get three bug hits in a day. It's just not happening. Are those anecdotal reports backed up by any kind of science that you know of as a biologist?
Well, I'm not, unfortunately, a scientist who's focused on insects, unfortunately, but I can tell you anecdotally, I've had the same experience myself in the springtime driving through the Central Valley of California. I've been here for about 26 years, and say 15 or 20 years ago, driving through Central Valley in the springtime especially, you would just be covered with insects. You'd have to probably stop multiple times to fill up your windshield wiper fluid just so you could keep the windshield clean. It was bothersome, but you also felt like, well, you know, this is a good thing because, you know, these insects are reproducing, they're providing food for a lot of animals. It seemed like a normal thing. Anecdotally, I can tell you that over the last 10 to 15 years, it's been you just don't see it like that anymore. It's clearly gotten to a situation where we are no longer, I think, experiencing, or we're now starting to experience, a real decline on the fundamental food webs on this planet. And it's an incredible concern. And all I can say is to all of your listeners out there, support politicians who believe in climate change and want to do good for the world. All the other stuff that you talk about, as important as it is, and as much as I support it, doesn't mean anything if we can no longer live on this planet. And,
amen.
Amen. You know, amen. Thank you for your good work. I really appreciate it, and I will be listening.
Thanks, Britt, and thanks for the rant. Appreciate it. Daryl in Danville, New Jersey. Hey, Daryl, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I just have a few things, if you can bear with me for a second.
Pick one, please.
Well, going back to the death of this journalist in Turkey in the Saudi embassy.
Right. Mr. Khashoggi.
You know, yeah. You recall back in September of 2016 when James Woolsey quit the Trump campaign?
Specifically, I don't, but continue.
Yeah, he quit, and he was the one that informed the FBI that Flynn was planning with the Turks to whisk Fethullah Gulen, the cleric that lives in the Poconos.
I remember that now. Yes,
for $15 million, he was going to whisk him back to. And you know what Erdogan was going to do with that cleric?
Oh, I'm guessing he was going to put him on trial and kill him.
He was going to put him on trial and kill him for because he said he was involved in planning that coup.
Right.
And so it's real rich for me to hear Turkey pointing the finger at Saudi Arabia. And also, anybody who thinks for a second that Donald Trump did not know that this was going to happen is smoking something.
Well, I want to know what happened in the phone call that MBS, the guy who's running Saudi Arabia, had 2 days before this happened with Jared Kushner. You know, the last time these guys were together, they were up until 4 o'clock in the morning, two nights in a row, you know, smoking or drinking or just whatever they were doing, and, you know, plotting how to rule the world, these two young 30-something princes, basically. And almost immediately after that, and there's large, widespread speculation now, including among people in the intelligence community, that Jared Kushner shared classified information with MBS about people in his own family and court who were not entirely loyal to him, because he went on a purge and some people died and some people lost all their money or large chunks of their money, and everybody was scared to death. And then Kushner has another phone call with him, and then 2 days later, you got this Washington Post journalist is slaughtered.
And somehow Jared Kushner is no longer upside down on his Manhattan property.
Right.
And, I mean, this is the problem with having corrupt leaders. They are so easily blackmailed. Even if Trump wanted to say something to the Saudis, by now I'm sure they have so much crap on him. There's nothing he can threaten them with.
Well, and they're funding his family. I mean, the Trump crime family is, for the last decade or so, has been, you know, growing. Whether it's the Kushner branch of it or the Ivanka, Don, Eric branch of it, and Donald, has been growing based on money from, you know, by and large, fairly autocratic regimes all around the world. Daryl, I got to run, but thank you for the call, and my apologies to everybody else on hold. We will pick up, you know, tomorrow. Give us a shout back. In the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport, as Mr. Obama used to tell us, as Mr. Sanders used to tell us, as so many people, as Hillary Clinton used to tell us. Get out there, get active, tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.